the arrival of Jesus Christ on the scene of human history is a very disturbing event, or you could say earth-shaking. It's like an earthquake, because he doesn't fit into any categories that we understand. He makes these claims and demands and proclamations. Anyone who can say, "I am the way, the truth, and the life," is speaking on a level that no one else has ever spoken. Now, it's a good kind of earthquake. It's a good kind of shaking, because he's establishing a whole new kingdom, but it's still a demanding one. Sometimes when Jesus invites people to follow him, he puts it in a very appealing way. "Come follow me, I'll make you fishers of men. Come to me, all you who labor and are overburdened, I will refresh you," things like that. He makes it clear that he has come not simply to make demands, but to offer refreshment, offer hope, new life, freedom. That's very clear. But it's also very clear in the Gospels that he makes extraordinary demands as well. And today's Gospel, in fact, both of today's readings are examples of this. The demands of being a follower, the cost of being a disciple. So Jesus speaks about hating our family members and carrying our cross and renouncing all our possessions. And St. Paul, in today's first reading, speaks about being poured out as a libation. A libation is a sacrificial offering. It's like a waste, just poured out on the ground. So Jesus, in inviting us to be his disciples, is not giving us a false advertising. He's not saying this is going to be a picnic or a day in the amusement park. I remember some years ago, a big university here in the metro area advertised a special deal to attract students, so 50% off. You can get a good education for a very low price. So people signed up, and then in the fine print, you had to have extraordinarily high grades. And if you don't follow all these conditions, well, you're going to have to pay more and all these things. It was a bit of false advertising. But Jesus doesn't do false advertising. He wants people to know from the beginning that he has, yes, a very great offer, but a very costly offer. That's why he uses these analogies in today's gospel of what it's like to construct a tower, or what it's like to go into battle against an opposing king. These are examples, they're not perfect analogies, but they're examples of human activities which require a certain amount of forethought. You consider from the beginning whether you have the resources to complete the project or not. And if you don't, don't start. If you're going to enter into a battle, determine ahead of time if it's even possible to win or not. And if it's not, well, then don't do it. So it's a way of saying, if you want to be a follower of Jesus, don't walk into it without a little bit of prudence. Don't go with your eyes closed. Open your eyes and see what it's going to mean. Now, building a tower is a great project, and anyone who completes a big project feels very good about himself. Anybody who defeats a larger army and gains the victory feels really good. But those are nothing by comparison to being a disciple of Jesus. Building a tower or defeating an opponent, nothing. Who cares about that? But joining Jesus in the great project of building the kingdom of God, entering into eternal glory with him, that's a great project. So let's look at what he says is the cost. First thing he says, and he's talking to large crowds now, people who are already attracted to him. Great crowds are traveling with him. And as if to say, don't Don't just get caught up in the enthusiasm of the crowd here. Think about what you're doing. He says, if anyone comes to me without hating his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Well, that's strong language. I don't hate my family, you? Well, he says, if you don't hate your father, your mother, wife, children, brothers and sisters, and even your own life, you cannot be his disciple. Why does he say it like that? He can't mean what it sounds like. He can't mean you have to hate your children. Because just Sunday, we learned that the two great commandments are love God with your whole heart and love your neighbor as yourself. And the closest neighbors are our own family members, right? Charity begins at home. You can't start with loving our neighbor and hating your own children or your own family members. So it can't mean what it sounds like, but it does mean that there is an absolute distinction between our relationship with God and everything else. If you're going to put it in black and white terms, there's love and there's hate. And you can't have the same for both parties. It's like Jesus says, you can't love God and love money. It's one or the other. Well, it's something like that here, and Jesus is trying to make it clear. You can't love God, or you can't be a disciple of Jesus Christ, and at the same time, make your family your highest priority. You can't. Remember what he said on Sunday. Love God with your whole heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. It's an absolute demand. God has to be absolutely the first. And by comparison, everything else is unimportant, by comparison. Now, whether we call that hatred or not, I don't know. Maybe I hope I'm not watering down the gospel. But I think Jesus is deliberately putting it strongly so that there be no confusion about what's first in life. God is first. And if he's not, well, then we can't be a disciple of Jesus Christ. He says, if you don't do this, you can't be my disciple. Okay, so hating our family, hating ourselves, hating our own life. Well, that sounds like terrible psychological disorder, to hate your life. That sounds like a pathological, some kind of a condition that would have to be treated by a professional therapist. You hate your own life? Well, he's not talking about that. He's not talking about rejection of the good that we are. He's talking about putting in right order our loves. Love of God first, not love of self first. I'm not the first and most important thing in my life. Now, there is such a thing as self-hatred, and that is a disorder. Because it's a rejection of God. It's a rejection of who God made, the good that God is doing, meaning ourselves. We're made in God's image, so we're good. But we're not God. So we don't place ourselves on the pedestal that replaces God. Okay, so that's the first thing. Then he says, whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. We know the cross in Jesus' day was the horrible method of execution. We interpret it with, because we're used to this kind of language, we interpret it more broadly, but he's certainly talking about suffering. Whoever does not suffer, does not willingly suffer in following him, cannot be his disciple. So if we are absolute in our rejection of suffering in our life, we can't be a disciple of Jesus. If we say, I won't suffer, I won't let this happen, I won't let this come into my life, I won't pay this price, we cannot be his disciple. It's that blunt. Now, our natural tendency is, of course, to reject suffering. That's normal. Even Jesus had an aversion to suffering. But to close the door on suffering, even when God is allowing it, or it's part of his will, but that's to say no to God, and that's the disaster for a disciple. Okay, then he goes into the comparison of the building of the tower and the battle, meaning this is a long, arduous project. It's not something we just do in one day. You don't build a tower overnight. It takes years. It's a long battle. We're in a battle here. This is not just one decision. It's a long process. Then he comes to the end and says, in the same way, every one of you who does not renounce all his possessions cannot be my disciple. So this is another way of saying the same thing. You know, possessions cannot take priority. To renounce possessions might mean to give them away. Is that sometimes the demand of God? But even if it doesn't mean that, because you have to have some possessions to take care of your families, it does mean it means putting them in a relative space, in a relative position on the list of priorities. So we cannot have in our list of things to do, okay, I'm going to buy a new refrigerator, I'm going to go to Jollibee, I'm going to love God, I'm going to finish my email. No, those things are not the same. Love of God is the first thing. And everything else has to fall into place. Now, this sounds too demanding to us. It can sound too intimidating. And that would be bad if I left you there. So let's go to St. Paul and see how he puts this. Paul understands this very well, the great cost, the great effort that it takes to be a disciple. He practices this in his own life. And this letter to the Philippians is a very joyful letter. It doesn't discount the great cost, but it puts it into the context of what a great thing it is to be a disciple. I mean, this is something that should, even though some aspect of it or another might not appeal to us, the project as a whole is a great project. It really is worth something doing and advertising. That's evangelization, right? We don't evangelize by saying this is really terrible and costly. We evangelize by saying this is really great. This is a way to joy, to freedom, to fulfillment, to every possible dream coming true. That's what this is. So this isn't just the cross and no resurrection. It's not suffering and no relief. It is a cross. It is suffering. But there's a purpose of it, a purpose for it, and that purpose is really worth it, makes everything worth it. So this is St. Paul. He says, work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for God is the one who, for his good purpose, works in you both to desire and to work. Now, the word work comes up three times in this few lines. First of all, we're supposed to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, meaning there is something that's on us here. This is our responsibility, and we have to apply ourselves to it. It is intimidating on a certain level, right? Fear and trembling, meaning respect the cost. But then he says, God is the one who, for his good purpose, now God's good purpose is much higher than our imagination can stretch, for his good purpose works in you. Now it's God doing the work, right? We're working, but God is the one working in us both to desire and to work. So beneath our work, at the foundation of our work, is God's work. And God's purpose is greater than our purpose. So this idea of working out our salvation in fear and trembling is not as intimidating as it sounds at first. It's a participation in a much greater work. It's doing something that by ourselves we couldn't do anyway. But with God at work in us, in fact, God giving us the desire in the first place, God planting in us the very idea that there's hope, with that at work, then we can, yes, we persevere. I won't go into every detail here, but it's a beautiful pondering about what effect this has on us and on the world. We shine like lights in the world. But then Paul ends in this particular selection in a very, very positive note. After saying, even if I'm poured out as a libation, even if I'm absolutely wasted in my efforts to serve the Lord and to serve you, I rejoice and share my joy with all of you. See how positively he concludes this. In the same way, you also should rejoice and share your joy with me. And this is very important, to know that this is a joyful adventure. If we only stress the cross and the suffering, we'll miss this. We'll miss what's really essential. In the very same breath where Paul talks about being poured out and sacrificing himself for others, he says, I rejoice. He uses the word for joy four times, or variations of this word joy. I rejoice, I share my joy with you, you rejoice, and you share your joy with me. The four times he's talking about joy. Joy that we have in ourselves, joy that we share, joy that others have and they share with us. It's a project which overflows with joy. It doesn't mean we're giddy happy all the time. We have lots of reasons why we're unhappy and we grieve and we experience sorrow, especially in these times. But our joy is not defeated by the sorrows. The cross does not defeat our hope in the resurrection. No. If we are without joy, something essential is missing from our Christian life. And we say this even in the face of Jesus saying we have to hate our family and take up our cross and renounce all our possessions. Yes. Yes, they go together. The cost goes together with the reward. And the reward is much greater than the cost.